There's one thing we haven't seen much of in the third season, and that's the holodeck.
Yeah.
And we see a lot of it in Hollow Pursuits.
A lot of bullshit, too.
Okay.
I did not like this episode.
I like this one.
You liked...
So last week, we both disagreed on Tin Man.
Yeah.
And I think we kind of came around to each other's point of view a little bit in that one. Why didn't you like Hollow Pursuits?
Because I goddamn hated Barkley. I just...
All right.
He is creepy and horrible.
I have some problems with Barkley as a character, I will say. He comes back.
Ugh.
I will just say that.
Oh.
He is a slightly recurring character. What did you not like about him? I think this episode broke you, maybe.
Yeah, it was just... There was...
Is it hitting a little too close to home for you, Richard?
It's hitting a little too close to home, reminding me of when, you know, I made erotic fan fiction holodeck movies of all of my friends.
I remember when that happened. It was pretty bad.
Yeah, you know, you just were in this toga saying, I am the goddess of empathy.
Well, let's, I mean.
It was a lot of funny scenes in a lot of crappy parts, I think.
Well, I think that this episode actually has a lot of really intriguing things to say about how they've constructed the interpersonal relationships on this show.
Okay.
Frankly, I think that they kind of make it as so you're in the in crowd, everyone's cool and they love you. If you're a little weird, everyone's a fucking dick to you. And I kind of like that. It makes the show a little bit crunchier. One of the problems that I've always had with The Next Generation in general is that everyone gets along too much. And I like seeing a character that doesn't fit in. I like seeing a character that makes other people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I like seeing a character that is uncomfortable, frankly, and kind of makes everybody out to be a little bit of a dick.
It's one of those, yeah, everyone's a dick, but at the same time, it's not completely surprising why he's a dick, because he is, you know, they use the phrase non-enterprise material at the very beginning of the episode, and let's be frank about it. At the beginning of the episode, Barkley is not enterprise material. There is this...
See, I disagree with you. I think he is. I think
he needs to be molded into that, and it's a failure of Geordi's to not have properly trained him, really.
Well, I think what really you're seeing is that they are very good at a certain type of person with a certain type of personality as a crew member on this ship. When they get somebody who's a little strange, frankly, as Barkley is, and we can talk about, you know, what exactly is going on with him as a person, that they fall on the job. I think that this shows that the Enterprise crew, Riker, Picard, you know, Geordi, everyone who's sort of a senior staff member who frankly sets the tone for the rest of the crew who train everybody else, who sort of, you know, this is the way things are going to be. Everyone's got to fit in, that they're not really good at it when they're faced with a little bit of a challenge. They want to get rid of him. And I think that's a little bit of a problem, frankly.
Oh, I don't disagree. And, you know, again, it turns out that Picard basically just says, look, Geordi, it doesn't matter that he's not fitting in now, you gotta figure out how to get him to do that. And, you know, ultimately these events of this episode, this is another episode where Geordi learns how to be a leader a little bit better.
Yeah, because, you know, of course, this is an episode about a guest star who we haven't seen before. But it is also in large part an episode about Geordi and how Geordi is learning to be the chief engineer. He really does have a crew of people that he has to be the leader to. And I also like the fact that we get to see Geordi in a different relationship with the people that he's being in charge with, because we haven't really seen him in charge of people before, I don't think. And he does a good job with them when they're all sort of gung-ho to impress him. But, you know, Barkley doesn't really seem all that interested in impressing Geordi. And in fact, doesn't seem to be comfortable around Geordi. But Geordi hasn't done much to make Barkley comfortable around him. And so it's almost as though, you know, Barkley and Geordi are people that don't really get along. And I like that they don't get along.
Yeah, I mean, Geordi even says, like, look, it's, you know, he's just somebody that I don't get on with. You know, that happens.
But I like the fact that Geordi is dressing Barkley down, and then in the next scene, Picard is dressing Geordi down.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Geordi is calling Reginald Barkley out on some of his bullshit, but not all of it. At the same time, I think Picard is, and you know, Picard's not in this episode very much, but except for one great scene. But but I think that anybody who's watched that will probably know which one I mean. But you know, Picard is obviously the person who is in charge. He's the one who's able to see everything, and he's able to realize what Geordi is doing, and he's able to dress Geordi down and say, "We're not getting rid of this guy. You need to figure out a way to manage him appropriately." Yeah. Because we're not going to make him someone else's problem. And frankly, I don't think that he's a bad crew member. It yeah. seems, right? You know, this is not a ship that Picard is not a captain who wants to give up on anybody. And so it's a little strange to me that Riker and Geordi are very gung-ho about getting rid of him.
You know, Riker, you know, and I'm surprised they didn't go more into this because, you know, Geordi's thing is that he, you know, he's blind, but he has this visor thingy, which, you know, compensates and goes over that. And there was a little noise in the first season about how he really wanted to have his eyesight, but, you know, they don't really care about that. And in a way, I can see Geordi's point being, well, I've never really had to deal with, you know, I'm different from everybody. I have what is a disability. I have something that, you know, would, but I haven't let this stop me. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think Geordi thinks of it as a discipline problem more than anything, because, you know, again, you know, so what? We all have our issues. We all have stuff that we're uncomfortable about or nervous about. We all get scared, but at the end of the day, we have to do this because this is the mission. I think in a way they all think that Barkley is shirking his duties rather yeah. than, you know, and you know, Troy's point is, well, no, he must be terrified, you know.
Let's just talk about it. I think that you know, Barkley is, there's a scene in 10 Forward where Geordi and Barkley are talking, and Geordi says that Barkley is shy. And Barkley seems to sort of internally, you know, get very tense at that, and then says, "Oh, I'm just shy. Yeah, that makes it so easy."
Well, no, I thought of that. I thought that was a different scene then, because what he said was, you know, shy. You make it sound so easy. Like, I think Geordi's saying, you know, oh, you're shy. It's nothing. And you know, Barkley's saying, yeah, you can say it very easily, but when you actually have some kind of social anxiety.
Well, that's what I want to get at.
Yeah.
Like, is that this episode is before social anxiety disorder
yeah.
is a thing. Like, it was yeah. not commonly known at this point.
No.
I mean, this is what, 1990? So, you know, the mental health field and the sort of knowledge of mental health in 1990 was very different from what it was
yeah.
in 2014, and which it was very different in 1970 and 1950. You know, certainly there were mental issues that people knew of, and certainly, you know, there were things like schizophrenia and, you know, mental disorders, things like that, depression. But I think even back then, you know, the idea that someone who is shy, I mean, I think it's very interesting that the script uses the word shy, because that's not a word you hear that much anymore.
Yeah.
I think this is very much an episode which is a little bit of its time in a way, but it is also very Prussian in a way, because it is saying that Barkley being shy, and it doesn't know the term social
yeah.
anxiety disorder, is actually a real problem,
well,
and is a medical condition that needs intervention from Troy and probably Beverly Crusher.
Yeah.
And nobody seems to really get that except for Barkley and probably Troy, which I think is interesting.
And, you know, there are points to the, where later as the episode goes on, and I did like the scene after, when Geordi goes into the holodeck and he sees that, you know, again, he's made a Three Musketeers with everybody, you know, he does say, you know, they're in 10 Forward, and he's saying, like, you know, look, I've had my days in the holodeck. I mean, we've seen some of Geordi's holodeck adventures, you know.
And I think Geordi is coming at the holodeck from a slightly different place than Barclay. I think that Geordi is very comfortable. You know, certainly Geordi doesn't have any sort of social anxiety or shyness or anything like that. But,
no.
You know, he definitely has issues, I think, with women.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that he's able at this point in the episode.
He fell in love with a holodeck lady. Yeah.
Right. He explicitly says that to Barclay. And I think, you know.
Another callback. I like how they do that.
Yeah. He realizes that I think Barclay needs to hear things like that from Geordi.
Yeah.
Geordi is sort of this omnipresent authority figure that is very scary to Barclay. Once Geordi sort of realizes that maybe if he talks to Barclay and gets kind of interested in him as a person and kind of reveals that he also has his own issues, that Barclay will start to feel more comfortable around
and
him.
And I think that's when Geordi starts to realize that. You know, again, maybe I think he's at the beginning of the episode, he sees Geordi, he sees Barclay, and let's face it, probably all of the guys in engineering, none of them are probably the most suave guys around there. They're probably all have their own shynesses and, you know, whatever. But, you know, Geordi says, yeah, well, we all got through this. We're all a bunch of nerds and we do our stuff. Why isn't Barclay doing that? I think when he sees the extent of the holodeck, he begins to realize that, oh, no, actually, maybe it's a lot worse than we had it.
He uses the term holodiction.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, the first time that they've ever mentioned that.
But in the context of the episode, it seems like a term. Like, it's not like Geordi is not making it up at that moment.
Yeah, no, he's not. And I think the idea of an addiction to the holodeck is really interesting because it's something the show hasn't touched on before.
Yeah, and it's a joke kind of about the holodeck, you know, that a lot of people say.
Yeah, and I can kind of see, you know, there are some serious. I think it's an episode which is meant comedically in a lot of ways, and it's meant to be a lighter episode, but I think it's also dealing with a lot of really serious issues about mental health and how we treat people with mental health. And, you know, frankly, I think the idea of someone who has such profound social anxiety disorder as Barclay seems to. And of course, I don't want to overstate the case of how great this episode is because I don't think it's a great episode, but I do like it. And I think it's a solid episode that it does deal with mental illness on the level that most television shows do, which is that it's cured in one episode. And to its credit, I think it's nice that the show doesn't show Barclay as completely cured at the end of the episode.
No, he's got it. He's been able to do something and he's, you know, I think it's very. See, that very last scene, I like that, number one, Barclay wasn't really the cause of everything, because he's not. He's not the reason that this contaminant was leaked to these places.
Oh, yeah, with all of the malfunctions on the ship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the world's scariest dribble glass. I thought that was secretly going to be that Barclay's putting pranks on everybody, and it's scary. But, you know, and I like that Barclay doesn't solve it all himself, but he's working with the team and they're all kind of like, he brings this initial idea and then like all of them are kind of just, you know, taking, you know, helping narrow it down.
Well, and
that's important because, you know, the thing is not getting Barclay to realize that he can do stuff on his own or that he is smart, because I think he knows that stuff. I think he's fine when he's on his own, but the fact that he can work with this team and that the team can work with him.
Yeah, and I think it's something as simple as knowing that he needs a little bit more attention. And once he gets it, he's better, right? Like, he's not better in the sense that he's cured, but better in the sense that he's able to handle himself a little bit more easily around these people.
I mean, the meeting that he has before Wesley fucks it up, he's doing kind of okay. I mean, he doesn't show up early, but he shows up kind of on time. He's not giving the best presentation, but he sort of has an answer, you know, and I know that, you know, I mean, it's very obvious what Geordi is doing in that scene. That's kind of management 101. You give your, you know, underperforming, you know, the way he says, like, okay, you know, well, that'll be your responsibility, and I'll see you at 8, and you'll be there, you know, and, you know, just with all the confidence in the world and setting these expectations, and because Barclay has not had any expectations on him.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it really shows the degree to which Barclay, I think, wants to actually do a good job as well. Like, there's nothing in Barclay that he's shirking his duty. It's just that he does have this, you know, he has a mental disorder. And, you know, especially with the talk of Hollow addiction and things like that. I mean, you know, he shows up at the meeting generally on time, but later when he's supposed to be on the bridge at a certain time and he's very late, I think number one, oh, he doesn't show up at all.
He falls asleep.
He falls asleep on the holodeck. And I think that kind of is, it's a fake out on the episode's part, because on the one hand you think, oh, well, he showed up on time the first time. So, you know, in a normal episode of the show, I think it would have been getting better and better and better until it hit some kind of, you know, capper. Right. And there's a, like, there's an interpersonal ramp up at the end where he falls asleep on the holodeck and they all find out exactly what's going on with him. And then there's the, you know, sort of science fiction-y plot of the episode, which is sort of ramped up at the very end with almost the destruction of the ship, which is very incidental. And you kind of know that there's no way the ship is actually going to blow up. That he, you know, I like that it's a little bit of a relapse on Barclay's part. And it's a little realistic in that sense, because
he goes on a bender, basically.
Right, exactly. And while it's treated as a joke in some ways, I think it's also treated with a little bit of respect, because Troy has that counseling session with him where she's trying to help him. They realize that this holodeck thing is bigger than them and perhaps is more of a problem than they realized it was. And that Barclay also realizes that, I think. You know, he sort of gets into, he's able to understand from their reactions exactly what this looks like to other people,
and I think he knows that. But I like that they do treat the holodeck as simultaneously really funny. I mean, it is very funny when the characters, you know, come upon the versions of themselves, like, and Troy's reaction to seeing, you know, Goddess of Empathy Troy is funny, you know, and all, and Riker's reaction to that is funny. But at the same time, number one, they also make it clear that that's kind of there is a disturbing element to that, that it is a kind of a weird violation that he's using these, you know, real people in these kind of a scenario. Because this is, let's face it, a very tame, made-for-TV version of what people could be doing with the holodeck. There is probably a much more racy version of the Goddess of Empathy scene.
That was probably Program 9, the one that he did not delete.
You know, at the same time, I think, you know, when Troy says, like, no, this is kind of, it is very significant that this is what his fantasy is, you know, and this is how he, you know, you see how well he does, you know, act and interact in his fantasy world, and all of that is significant, and it shows that he does want to reach out to the people that he's around. He doesn't want, you know, He's not looking for a completely different world to escape into. He's looking for a version of the world where he has control.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that it would have been very different if the holodeck program that he had gotten into was something that was entirely different, devoid of people or, you know, whatever it was, right? Like, that would have probably indicated that he had more profound problems that they were probably able to deal with, or that they were able to sort of help him through. And I like the fact that they do sort of, when they get to that holodeck part of the episode and realize that, that he does have some serious problems and he needs more help than perhaps they thought he did in the beginning.
I'm just sad that Wesley didn't get spanked.
What
is he, like, eating a pie the entire time?
He's eating a pie, and he seems kind of,
like a little boy blue looking.
Yeah, no, that is exactly what it was. They actually, I was reading that they copied that costume exactly from the painting. Good use of their time, I guess.
I know, like, you can tell Patrick Stewart liked playing a Three Musketeer.
Yeah, we get to see Brent Spiner ham it up a little bit, which is always fun. Ugh. And then I think the one thing we haven't really talked about is Geordi and Guinan, because I'm surprised you haven't mentioned Guinan. She's in the episode a couple times.
This is not the best Guinan episode. It was a fine Guinan episode.
I liked it, and I liked her in this episode for two reasons. Number one, the yellow outfit she's wearing is just rocking. Number two, I think she's the character that cuts through the bullshit. And she really is the character which, you know, she is, aside from Barclay and then other, you know, sort of like one-off guest stars that are there to cause conflict, right? She was the first character in the show. She's not Starfleet. You know, she has no ties to these people. that in a way she is the character who is a little bit on the outside and everybody likes her. She's a little bit rough around the edges and she's a little sassy, I guess is a good word for it. But she's also able to sort of see through the bullshit and she's able to tell Geordi exactly what he's doing that's wrong. And that, you know, she is a character which is very wise and she's a character that's much older than these people ostensibly. I mean, she knows Q. How does she know Q? We don't know. There's a lot we don't know about Guinan, but
I mean, we're told her species is very, very, very long lived. She knows the Borg, get it right?
Yeah. They mentioned that at one point.
Yeah. But that's about,
yeah, that's about all we know at this point about Guinan.
And again, very, very old is about as far as we've, you know, that could be centuries, that could be millennia, you know?
Yeah. But I think, you know, Guinan's place in this episode is not incidental. And I think it's probably more important than most people realize because she really is the character that is able to see the good in anyone. And I mean, think back to how, what her role was in yesterday's Enterprise, for example, where, you know, she is able to very quickly pick up on the fact that everything is wrong. And that at the very end of the episode, what she wants to do is talk about Tasha Yar.
Yeah.
And in a similar fashion, I think that she respects Barkley because she says that he comes there, he drinks warm milk and he goes away and she doesn't bother with it.
You know, I loved that scene when, you know, she says he drinks a, you know, glass of warm milk and, you know, she and Geordi, you know, kind of chuckle for a second. And then she says, you know, but, you know,
Geordi chuckles.
She doesn't chuckle. Yeah. But she says, you know, warm milk is very good if you're having trouble sleeping. And that's one of those, you know, she knows exactly what that means. She knows he's going down just because, you know, he probably comes very late at night. He probably, you know.
Yeah.
She probably just sees him as this guy who just stumbles in just looking like hell and has a glass of warm milk, sits and goes.
But I think that's, but think about that though. He could have warm milk in his own quarters. The fact that Barkley comes to 10 forward to have warm milk before he goes to bed is indicative of something.
Yeah.
I think it might be indicative of the fact that he wants to reach out to people. He does want some socialization, but he just doesn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
If it makes him, I mean, again, he has social anxiety disorder, basically. He gets very anxious and doesn't know how to deal with people.
That bit where he says, I make up lines for what I do at a party, and then I'm trying to be cool looking at a plant.
That's classic social anxiety stuff.
Aw.
The one problem I have with Barkley as a character is it's a problem with the way that a lot of people think about introversion, which is that it's shyness, it's social anxiety disorder. You can't interact with people, these kind of things. And I kind of have a little bit of a problem with that because, you know, I don't necessarily think that just because Barkley is introverted that he has mental disorders.
I would not say that they're necessarily calling him particularly introverted because the cast has a mixture of introversion and extroversion.
That is
in it.
True.
Like, you know, yes, Riker is 100% an extrovert, you know. But then again, you have somebody like Geordi, who is probably much more introverted. Worf isn't exactly going out on the town every night.
True.
You know, Dr. Crusher probably just goes home. She and Wesley watch some TV and she goes to bed. Like,
they don't watch TV in the future. Remember that episode, The Neutral Zone?
They watch The Neutral Zone and they go to bed. I mean, part of that is most of these characters are at the age and the point of their careers where, you know, they aren't just naturally going to be that sociable. But, you know, we've seen plenty of characters, I think, who do like quieter lives or have more of a technical existence that aren't supposed, you know, I think that, you know, Barkley is kind of where that becomes pathological. It's not just shyness. It's not just introversion. It's not just, you know, a preference for quiet. It's actual panic act. You know?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what it is, though, is that it's not that it's introversion taken to an extreme. It's Barkley may be an introvert, but that has nothing to do with the fact that he also has this weird disorder, right? Like, he also is, you know, he's sick. I mean, he has a problem. You know, that has nothing to do with the fact that he likes to spend most of his time alone. And I think that's kind of the issue that I have with the character.
Yeah. But again, he doesn't like to spend his time alone. He just does spend his time alone.
I think that, yeah.
He's not happy about spending his time alone, because if he were introverted, it wouldn't be a problem, you know. A lot of people are bad at parties and shy at parties, but you know, there's a difference between, then I'm just not going to go to a party, whatever, I'm going to have a much better time, you know, and you do have a much better time at home. And, but you see him trying to do that and failing miserably. It's, he has the desire, but not the ability.
Yeah. Well,
he might be an extrovert with social anxiety disorder.
He might be. Yeah, that's a good point. He might be. I mean, we don't know. We don't know enough about him to really judge that one way or the other.
Hey, we see his fantasy life as the swashbuckling adventure. So, I mean, he clearly wants something a little more active.
And I think it would probably be a more interesting take on the character if he was an extrovert with social anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
Because I think it's probably more... I don't want to say that it's harder for an extrovert to have social anxiety disorder than an introvert, but it's definitely probably more of a problem for them.
Both prevent you from doing the same things, except those things are more important to an extrovert.
Yes, that's true. And then I also don't think it's incidental that Picard is the character that screws up and calls him by that horrible nickname in front of him, because Picard is the most confident person.
Yeah,
he's the one that's most in control. He's the one who's able to, really set himself apart from everybody else. And yet he's the one who who embarrasses himself and embarrasses Barclay and everybody else.
Yeah. And, you know,
so I think that goes a long way towards, you know, I mean, obviously Barclay is not happy about that and Picard is obviously not happy about it. But I also think it shows Barclay that even Picard messes up.
Yeah. Okay. That's kind of nice.
I don't know. Did I change your mind about Barclay at all?
A little bit.
I hope so, because he comes back. I'm just going to keep reminding you of that.
I know. And there's going to be one episode where he and the Waxana Troy get married, and it's going to be the worst thing ever. Oh my God, does that really happen?
I'm not saying anything.
Oh God, he and Waxana Troy get married.
I'll give this one 7. I don't know 7 what, just
6
7.
Dribble glasses.
There you go. Well, let's move on to The Most Toys. I hadn't seen The Most Toys in a few years, and I didn't remember liking it very much, but on this rewatch, it's one of my favorite episodes from this season so far.
I didn't like the very beginning, because I thought, oh, this is just a Trelane episode, but it's not as interesting. But, you know, the main dude, what's the bad guy?
Keevis Fajo?
Yeah, Keevis, you know, whatever his name is. Like, he is a bland character in some ways, but that's not the point of the episode. You know, the point of the episode is really, this is all Data. This is just kind of the character is not that dynamic of a character because it's not about him in a way. He is a kind of a generic villain.
Yeah, this episode is designed around Data. It's designed to tell us things about Data that perhaps we did not know before. Perhaps Data didn't even know before. I think it's designed really to test Data in a similar fashion to the way that I think Picard was tested in Allegiance. And what I like about this episode is that it doesn't shy away from the darkness of it.
No.
And I think this is, you know, it's funny because I had sort of remembered this episode as kind of goofy. And I don't know why I thought that. Keevis Fajo is kind of a goofy character.
He looks a little like Kevin MacDonald, and I keep in my mind having him played by Kevin MacDonald, and that was like kind of the very beginning. I was picturing him as a lot more of a buffoon character.
Yeah, he's one of those actors that he's kind of this character actor, and he's been in a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
I remember him mostly from the HBO movie about the AIDS crisis and the band played on. I think he played one of the CDC doctors or something. So it's kind of in a very different context. And... you know, I think I remember that because he's sort of a clownish figure. He's very, he kind of fancies himself as some sort of, you know, man about town or man about space.
Yeah, he's a dandy, let's face
it. Yeah, but yeah, that's a good word for him. I think he's a dandy, and I think he's a dandy in a similar way to, he's kind of a cross, I guess, between Trelane and Harry Mudd, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, that it seemed, and that's where original series and maybe even season one would have taken this episode.
I think so, yeah. And what's interesting about it is that they realize that he's not the focal point of the episode. I think if this had been a second season or a first season episode, it would have been all about Keevis Fajo. And what they make it about instead is what is Data's breaking point? How does Data get out of this? And interestingly, you know, Data doesn't try really to get out of the situation. I mean, I think, you know, it's really an episode about Data's thought processes and Data's morality. And, you know, I think a lesser version of this episode would have had him try to escape, you know, whatever it is. And I think to the episode's credit, it's a very, very deliberative, slow episode that really shows us that there are still bad, bad things in this universe, and that Data is willing to make a difficult choice. Because at the end of the episode, not only does Data decide to kill Kivas Vajo, but he lies to Riker about it. And Riker knows he's lying.
And he even acts, I would say at the very end, he's sadistic towards Vajo as well. Like, he does a lot, he does in a row three fairly dark things.
I mean, I don't know that
I came off like that to me, but then again, you know, I'm thinking that Data has emotions.
I mean, why do you say sadistic? I mean, what did he do to Kivas Vajo to give you that impression?
Basically saying, like, all your stuff's taken away, and, you know, I'm just an android. I have no feelings. And
Like,
that line, that's him just, that's Data's final fuck you in this episode. Like, he does, you know, right before that moment, you know, Data doesn't get to kill Vajo, but he gets to destroy him.
Well, I think, you know, yeah, I guess so. But I think what I kind of had a different take on that scene, and it's basically Data. It's Data telling Vajo that there are consequences to his actions, and that for Data, I think that was a way for him to get closure on the whole experience and also to put a capper on what Vajo did to Data and sort of make it right in his own mind.
Well, it's interesting because the fact that, I mean, everybody in, like, I think Vajo's an interesting villain because it is kind of a banality of evil thing. He's just a greedy dude. That's all, you know, he just wants stuff and he gets stuff. There are people in the world who like collecting things and like collecting unique things and don't mind screwing each other a little out, you know, more. That's what it's. This, we're not dealing with a con figure. We're not even dealing with a skin of evil type of thing. We're just dealing with a greedy asshole.
Yeah, and I, you know, and it's funny because I don't think that Kivas Vajo is supposed to be a villain. I don't think he's evil. I think that he is very, very amoral in a way that a lot of people like this are amoral.
Yeah,
and he really believes that the ends justify the means. You know, and frankly, I don't think that he really thinks as of Data as a person. I don't think that he believes Data has rights or anything like
that.
But
the thing is, he doesn't believe anybody seems to have rights. And in a way, everybody in his complex is dealing with just petty greed. I mean, he basically, all of his workers, he partially, I mean, the woman that, you know, Data talks to, you know, she basically says it's partially he gives us a lot of rewards, partially he's going to give us really good, you know, bad punishments if we don't. So everybody is there probably treated on a day-to-day basis fairly well by Vajo. I think Vajo has realized how to make people tick.
It's carrot and stick, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Is what Vajo has.
And I think, he probably prefers to do carrots because it's a lot easier.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, and I think it's interesting because he really shows his colors when he threatens to kill the woman who I forget her name. And did we even get a name for her? I don't remember.
No.
But, and that's what the point when she realizes what kind of a dangerous man he is and what kind of a dangerous situation he is. Because I think Vajo is really, you could call him a sociopath. I don't think that he has any moral bearings. And I don't think that he even thinks of other people as people or doesn't think that they're important.
He's one of those views people as tools. But I don't know, in a way, this episode makes me almost think about Data is in some ways, if we want to talk D&D alignments, he's a lawful good sociopath. It's good that he's on the side of what we view as the, you know, correct morality in this, but he's not necessarily doing it out of a sense of empathy or, you know what I mean? Like, his morality is not based on how anybody else around him feels, but on kind of a cold morality. I mean, his decision to kill Vajo is essentially the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. He attempts to give somebody a very brutal, painful death because more people are hurt by this guy. He doesn't, of course, know that he's about to beam up, but at that moment, that's really the best decision.
Yeah, and I don't think that Data was going to shoot Kivas Vajo with that disruptor. because it would cause him pain.
No.
I think that was the vehicle that he had to stop Fajo.
He had a button that would just painlessly do something versus that.
If he had a Federation phaser set on kill, that would just kind of kill him immediately and he wouldn't feel anything, I think he would have used that. I think he just had what he had at his disposal and he was going to use it.
Yeah.
What I find interesting about this episode really is that, you know, in a lot of ways, this is an episode about structure. This is an episode about law. It's an episode about society and how we trick ourselves into thinking that there's some sort of society, you know, what society actually is, because Data unmoored from the Federation, Data unmoored from Starfleet, becomes a character that is much more quietly threatening, I think, than the Data that we have known over the past 3 years. You know, he's very, he obviously, you know, he's doing all the non, you know, the passive resistance stuff.
Yeah.
You know, when Kivas Fajo brings that guy in and he just kind of stands there like a mannequin, Fajo pushes him over and he falls. You know, he refuses to do these things.
And I think Data accepts that, you know, no matter what, you know, you can't physically necessarily torture Data because he doesn't, you know, he can deal with that. But I think Data is thinking for the first half of the episode, like, what can he do to me? The worst thing he can do to me is kill me. And then he's not going to do that because I'm too valuable. And, you know, there is that moment when Data says that and he's thinking, like, this is my trump. And Fajo's already, you know, I think it's interesting because Fajo is an effective, if not villain, antagonist, because he basically says, yeah, I thought about that. And yeah, I don't want to destroy you, but, you know, and it is interesting because he does play on Data's empathy for this woman. You know, if Data does want to, Data's not putting his own safety ahead of himself, but he is putting the safety of others. And whether that's just programming or whether that's feelings or whatever, it is an effective motivator for him.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get too far down into the road of Data's emotions and Data's kind of programming and what that means, because in a way, you know, we are all slaves to our, you know, biology. I mean, you know, there are, you know, many studies showing that people react to ways because of, you know, the way the brain is constructed and was constructed 50,000 years ago. So, you know, the fact that, you know, we could get into a whole conversation about does free will exist, but I want people to continue listening, so we're not going to do that. You know, what I think is really interesting is that Data seems to, I don't think Data forgets that there is law and there's a society out there, but Kivas Fajo is someone that kind of is the sand in the eye of Starfleet and the sand in the eye of Federation, because he's a character, you know, he has his own ship. He obviously has his own crew. He does what he wants. He goes where he wants. He doesn't seem to really be scared of consequences or scared of the authorities in any respect. I think that is offensive to Data.
Fajo's neutral in the sense that he's only out for himself.
But at the very end of the episode, when Data decides that he needs to kill Fajo, you know, why does he make that choice? Because Data knows that there is the Federation out there. Data knows that Fajo will be put on trial because, if for nothing else, he kidnapped a Federation citizen and a member of Starfleet, and Starfleet doesn't take that lightly. And so, you know, is that really the only choice that he can make? Is Data saying, well, you're someone who has lived your life outside of the confines of civilized society, so I am going to treat you like that right now?
Yeah, but here's the thing. I almost wonder if that act is as much symbolic as anything else. In other words, you know, Fajo gets punished either way, but, you know, Data's met at least one person who's kind of, you can assume that Fajo has a network of friends who are like that one guy he showed over there. He is not the only person in the galaxy who is swooping up endangered species and, you know, collecting anything. There's a dozen people who would want to have Data in their collection. You know, and I almost wonder if Data wanting to kill him would be sending a message to everybody. Not, you know, just, I think that's I think it's a threat towards that whole kind of network in a way. Like, the Federation does not take this shit nicely, you know. And, you know, there is a bit of, this is in the moment, there is a bit of, you know, this is the thing they need to do right now. Again, Data doesn't know that at that moment the Federation is coming for him.
You know, if the Enterprise were another hour out even, and, you know, he got his army to overtake Data, and let's say he finally decided Data was not worth the trouble.
Yeah.
He could very easily hide, you know, he's already faked Data's death. I mean, he could go a little further and without any sufficient evidence. You know what I mean? Like, I think at that moment, Data believes this is the only way to avoid this guy getting off scot-free.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And I think at the end of the episode when Kivas Fajo is in custody, and, you know, let's go back to the original series and Whom Gods Destroy, because that was the episode which sort of said that there was a cure for psychopathy. There was a cure for criminal insanity. And, you know, this is 70, 80 years later. So obviously, you know, Kivas Fajo is going to go to a Federation prison. He's going to be treated and rehabilitated. And then he's going to go and, you know, farm beets or whatever in a colony world. If he ever gets out of prison, I mean, yeah. Who knows? I don't know. And I, you know, from what we can infer from the way the Federation is, they don't seem to be the kind of society that would have a life imprisonment. You know, they figured out a way to rehabilitate people and cure people who have these issues. So
the Vietnam one a few weeks ago.
Right. So for Kivas and Data in that final scene where, well, not the final scene, but the final scene before that, where Data is sort of confronting him with the weapon, is, I think, you know, it's about Data not making that calculation or sort of making the decision that that is not a deserving punishment for Fajo in some way, and that Data needs to kill him because Data doesn't need to kill him. I mean, this is a decision that Data takes. It is not born out of necessity, I don't think. And I don't think that Data has... I don't think the Data has grappled with that, frankly. And I don't think the Data is someone... I mean, you know, because if this had been someone who had not been an android, I think he would have had, like, you know, PTSD after this experience or something.
But you could also make that... You know, understand. You had some. You know, if you had Riker in that situation, you could imagine a Riker who, maybe not specifically Riker, but if you had a human character, you could imagine him making that decision, grappling with that, deciding something in the heat of the moment. You know, deciding something out of emotion, out of extreme anger, out of extreme fear. He did just see, you know, this woman just gunned down in cold blood. You know, the fact that we're not sure why Data made that decision is. I mean, to me, it seems like it's more easily explained by an emotional reaction rather than a logical reaction in some ways.
I can kind of see that. And I think, you know, when Data says, what does he say? Something like, I cannot permit this to continue or something like that. I think that, you know, him saying that may have been his attempt to justify out loud his sort of like, emotional reaction to have revenge against this person.
Yeah, I mean, revenge and revulsion and incomprehension. I mean, he, at this point, I think Data doesn't see Fajo as human, if you know what I mean. Like, he's, I think, realized...
I don't think Fajo is human, but anyway.
Look, you know what I mean? Like, he sees him as not... he almost realizes how that this person is vermin in a kind of way.
Yeah.
Know, which Fajo kind of is.
He's kind of exterminating.
He's a parasite.
Him. Yeah, yeah. I want to talk a little bit about what was going on the Enterprise, though, in this episode, because it's not a big part of the episode, but I think it's interesting for a couple of reasons. It highlights how loved Data is by everybody.
Oh, yeah.
It gives some continuity to Data. And, you know, Picard sort of has to deal, I think, with... He's kind of dealing with his own mortality in this episode. He's not in the episode a lot, but he comments on it a couple times, which I think is weird. Geordi and Wesley go to Data's quarters and they pull out the medals and the Yar cube and all that stuff. So you get to see her again. And, you know, it's funny because Geordi realizes that something is amiss, not because anything was wrong necessarily, but because Data didn't do something that he always would do. And what I find interesting about that is this is an episode which, on the one hand, they're able to save Data because Data always does things by the book.
Yes.
And at the end of the episode, Data is not doing things by the book.
Yeah. Yeah, that is one of the ironies of the episode, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did think the episode had a lot of care into it. Like, At the point when Picard says, you know, gives Worf, you know, Data's old position, like, I literally wrote in my notes, this is the second time that, you know, Worf's been given a battlefield promotion, you know, and then...
Not only that, the second time that he has taken over for someone who's died.
Yeah, exactly. And then in kind of the very next scene,
which I don't know what that says about Worf necessarily, but...
But then,
you're not as good as these people, but if they die, you're our next choice.
The next scene, then you have Troy coming up to Worf and saying exactly that, like, this is the second time. Are you okay? And, you know, they have a little moment. It's not a massive thing of angst for him, but she does remind him, you know, he does say, you know, if I were a Klingon, this is how that happens. And, you know, he does come to the, I have to honor them by... you know, doing their job well and, you know, remembering them and all of that.
Right.
And for Worf, that's the... I like that, you know, we're starting to see Troy do her job more, I think, and I kind of like seeing her do her job well.
I think Troy is one of those characters that has gotten a bad rap. I think that when she gets episodes focusing on her, they're usually not great, but they're usually not great because the writers don't know exactly what to do with her when she's the focal point. But when she's just kind of flavor of the episode, you know, when she's kind of there to do something.
I mean, her job is literally to help people deal with the stresses and the problems of life. And she does that in this episode.
She does that in this episode, and I think she does it well.
Yeah.
You know, I think everybody does their jobs competently in this episode, really. You know, the only reason I can really think that the episode may suffer is because I think they leave a little too quickly, you know. If I have to find a criticism of the episode, it's just that, right? That they sort of, like,
they could have made the crisis seem a little more serious, you know what I mean? Like that
yeah, because I kind of feel like if your shuttlecraft blows up and one of your members of your crew die, you're going to do more than a cursory examination.
Yeah,
you know, that's kind of my only thing.
Or,
but
you know, even they didn't even have some of us will stay behind and, you know, will the other rest, or there is no contingency made to that.
Yeah. And I think the other thing about the episode, which I kind of struck me this time, is, you know, Kivas Fajo says that he collects things that are one of a kind. He has this baseball card, this weird, you know, insect thing, which frankly looked a little cute. And I kind of want one. Data's not one of a kind.
Ooh, we have lore.
Was Data omitting that information because he thinks Kivas Fajo would have just killed him? Or... did the episode forget that? I'm not sure what the answer is. I prefer that it's the first one, but I don't know.
I mean, to be fair, I mean, it doesn't necessarily make sense to, you know, for, you know, keep us, you're one of a kind. Well, actually, I have a psychotic half, you know, brother, you know.
I forget. Did Lore die at the end of the episode? I don't even remember. I sort of forgotten.
It's fuzzy. I think maybe it's for the best that, you know, Data Lore is just, you know, floated out.
It's something that happened. We never have to deal with it again.
You know, something, it was like the chicken pox. You know, I missed second grade pizza party because of that. But, you know, I'm over it now. We saw Data Lore. We don't have to watch it again.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, what would you give this one?
I would give this episode one unique object.
That's very nice. I'll go with that. All right, well, next week we are almost done with the third season.
Oh, good.
We're wrapping up second to last with Sarek. And wait for it.
I'm waiting.
Menage a Troy. Yep.
It could be Menage a Q a Troy.
It could be good. That's all I will say.
It could.
We'll talk to you next week.